At some point in the early 1940s, scholar and author C.S. Lewis received a review copy of a textbook, quote, for boys and girls in the upper forms of school, that is, for high schoolers. And while he was grateful to the authors for sending the book, at the same time he wrote, I shall have nothing good to say of them. Welcome to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Lewis tells the story of the textbook in the first of three lectures he delivered in 1943 and then published in the book, The Abolition of Man. Now, 75 years later, Wyoming Catholic College has chosen The Abolition of Man as our book of the year. And this is the first in a series of three podcasts about the book. This week, we will consider the first lecture that Lewis gave with the provocative title, Men Without Chests. In it, he focused on the radical subjectivity regarding morality that he saw all around him and the enormous damage it does and would continue to do to the human person. To talk to us about Men Without Chests, our guest this week is Wyoming Catholic College theologian, Dr. Kent Lisnowski. Dr. Lisnowski, let's begin with the textbook that Lewis received. He calls it the Green Book, and its authors Gaius and Titius. What did they say, and why did Lewis so vehemently object to them?
The authors of the Green Book claim that language is radically and incommensurably subjective, and that the subjectivity of language suggests that all the feelings related to our statements of value are irrational and therefore unimportant. To quote Lewis, all sentences containing a predicate of value are statements about emotional state of the speaker, and secondly, that all such statements are unimportant. So that's what the authors are after. Lewis resists this vehemently, not only in content, but really in the manner by which it's communicated. Because he's saying that these authors teach two lessons, without ever telling the student what those lessons are. And that's a kind of insidious pedagogy in Lewis's mind. The first lesson seems to be twofold, right? We kind of said it already, that first, all judgments of value are merely claims about emotional states. Now, emotional states, being subjective, are unimportant. In Lewis's words, all emotions aroused by local association are in themselves contrary to reason and contemptible. So we should only value rationality, not these emotions. The second lesson, and this is given in the advertisement that the authors deal with, is what's called debunking, right? They try to teach the students how to debunk claims. And so they say this, every claim of value can be debunked simply by showing its appeal to emotion. So the authors aren't really showing that the advertisement's bad writing, as they claim to be doing, but rather they're showing that the advertisement's working on the emotions. And so if it's working on the emotions, we can dismiss it. Now, the problem with all this, of course, is that nothing can avoid the power of this cynical debunking. The funny thing is about all this, and C.S. Lewis admits it, is that the authors may not even realize what they're doing. The students reading these texts will likely not realize what's happening to them. And language's power is limited to being a communication about our own feelings rather than about the reality of things in themselves.
Lewis comments, it's not a theory that they put into the student's mind, but an assumption. Then he goes on to say that while Gaius and Titius teach students nothing about letters, they have cut out of his soul, long before he's old enough to choose, the possibility of having certain experiences which thinkers of more authority than they have held to be generous, fruitful, and humane. Is that a little harsh, or how does subjectivity do that?
I would say, yeah, it is harsh, but the truth can be sometimes difficult to hear, sometimes harsh indeed. And so Lewis is saying that there are forms of education that carve away pieces of the soul. In this case, the piece or the part of the soul that's been cut out of the person is the possibility of being able to experience emotions correctly. The very idea that some realities demand that I feel a certain way about them, right? That it's good and right, it's fitting and sweet to die for the homeland. There's a claim somewhere that this is objectively the right way to feel. Now, the educators, the authors of the Green Book, would have us believe that we couldn't feel either rightly or wrongly about anything. The feelings themselves are irrational. Not that they're right or wrong, they're simply not the subject of rational discourse. And therefore, we couldn't ever feel the right way about something. That's a dangerous place to be. It means that a person could never have a kind of intuitive moral uprightness to their life. They'd always have to be performing some kind of moral calculus based on rationalized principles, rather than working from a robust sense of habit in being formed in the true, the good, and the beautiful.
So the Mona Lisa is not beautiful, but it makes me feel something, and I identify that with beauty, but it's really about me. It's not about Leonardo da Vinci's painting.
Exactly. So if you were to say the Mona Lisa is beautiful, according to the authors of the Green Book, all you're saying is, I feel a certain way about the Mona Lisa. So you're just communicating your emotional state to me. You're not really communicating anything about the Mona Lisa.
Now, he draws a distinction between that approach and what he calls the Tao. About the Tao, he writes, it is the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others are really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are. Unpack that a little bit for us.
Sure. What's really interesting here, I think, is that Lewis is doing, on the face of it, some general kind of interreligious dialogue. First of all, he's pulling from the religions of India and China to find a synonym for what the Christian West would call eternal law. And eternal law is simply the way God has made things to be, right? The order of the universe. And it's in his providence over all creation. Now, man participates or shares in the way things are by his power of reason. Man's rational share in the way things are is called natural law. Man, by light of reason, can know portions of God's providential ordering of the cosmos. He can even take a share in maintaining that order and ordering smaller things in accord with the larger order he sees. This identifying and co-ordering of man that he does is his way of sharing in God's eternal law, his way of sharing in God's providence. In other words, man is in touch with the Tao, the way things really are. Perhaps an analogy might help. Let's imagine I invent a new kind of transportation device. Let's call it the pentacycle. It's a five-wheeled, self-propelled person mover. Now, the principles by which my pentacycle operates are the Tao of this genius invention. A person using my invention could discover and work with those principles to do exciting and interesting things. Maybe things I've never even imagined. But if a person rejects those principles, or furthermore, claim that there are no such principles by which this pentacycle operates, not only will he be unsuccessful in riding my contraption, but he will also look like a fool. So what Lewis is doing here is saying, when we reject the idea that we can be in touch with the Tao, that is, the way things really are, we're going to be unsuccessful in adjudicating moral problems, and worse, we're going to look like fools.
Well, he seems to say that forsaking the Tao leaves people open to subjective morality, to cynicism, and to propaganda. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think for Lewis, that's the natural consequence of the situation, right? If we can't say what things really are, if we can't say that they really are a certain way, then we have to rule out any ability to claim that our reactions to them is either correct or incorrect. If we don't know what really is the case, we can't say we have an ordinate or a disordered approach to it. If, for example, back to the original conversation where these two people in the Green Book are talking about a waterfall, if a waterfall is not in fact pointing at something bigger than I am, then my humility in the face of it, my calling it sublime, won't make any sense. Now, it's not wrong, it's simply irrational. For it to be wrong, we'd have to say that the waterfall, in fact, points at something smaller than I am. But the authors of the Green Book aren't doing this. So once we go this route of rejecting the idea that our emotional responses are either rightly or wrongly ordered to the way things are, people are left open to subjective morality because there's no perceived need to be docile to any order beyond myself. There's no need to be docile to anything beyond the way I want things to be or the way I feel right now. In other words, there's no Tao, there's no eternal law, there's nothing to lean our morality against. So much for subjective morality. Now, when it comes to cynicism, we're susceptible here because it becomes the only legitimate way we can defend ourselves from value judgments that don't already align with our own. If I can identify an emotional, and therefore, according to this way of thinking, irrational component of my person's motivation or argument, then I've debunked them and I can dismiss them. I don't have to listen to it. It's merely emotional, right? So first, I'm subjective in my morality because I don't have to listen to anybody else. And then I become cynical because it's the way I defend myself against reasonable sounding arguments. Finally, I become prey to propaganda because I have no training in mastering myself. I'm actually, despite all my protestations, at the whim of every feeling and emotion and passion and impulse that I have. I have no way of knowing which ones to reject. And so when the propaganda machine hits me, I'm actually powerless to do anything against it.
Now, Lewis wrote that this way of thinking produces, quote, men without chests. What does he mean by that? And what characterizes men without chests?
Yeah, somehow for Lewis, the chest is our habit or ability of kind of moral weightlifting. It's our bench presses at the gym of self-restraint. It's our drilling in the sport of self-mastery. And sometimes even a self-goading, right? To not just restrain ourselves, but to push forward where we would rather not. The chest for Lewis is a mediator between intellectual man and animalistic man. It's that by which the head rules our belly, yet that by which the belly demands the head do something. So without chests, we're powerless to lift the weight of something like propaganda from our ribs. We're impotent even to recognize the truth, let alone be changed by it and convert.
Now, have we in fact in the Western world created men without chests?
Short answer, yes. Long answer is also yes, but let me explain a little bit. The amazing economic boon of the last 70 years in the market economy and the manifold increase in our access to material goods seems to have created a situation where it's easier for man to satisfy all of his visceral desires than it is to restrain himself from satisfying those visceral desires. In fact, there's no occasion to restrain ourselves anymore, since all the things that fulfill our visceral desires are almost infinitely and immediately available to us. We don't need chests, in other words. We've created a situation where they're unnecessary, from food to sex to relational acknowledgement. For food, well, we've got McDonald's and microwaves. For sex, there's pornography, contraception, and the hookup culture. For self-esteem, well, there's getting liked on Facebook, and there's emojis that I can text. Nothing demands patience. Nothing demands that moral bench press of the chest. Aristotle, when describing the virtue of temperance, asks his interlocutor, which person's happier? The one whose bucket is full of holes, but he lives right next to a pure spring. Or the person whose bucket is watertight, but he lives a good walk's distance from the spring. Now, Aristotle is going to hold that the latter man is the happier one, the man who possesses himself. Our society has discovered that it can make springs well up from almost anywhere, and has therefore designed a society around the assumption that the man with the hole-ridden bucket is happier. That man is Lewis's man without a chest.
The last paragraph of Men Without Chests is among the most quoted passage from all of C.S. Lewis. Quote, "And all the time, such is the tragicomedy of our situation, we continue to clamor for those very qualifications we are rendering impossible. In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests, and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful." Lewis went on in the second lecture to say, quote, "The practical result of education in the spirit of the Green Book must be the destruction of the society that accepts it." And that will be the subject of our next podcast. In his essay, "Why Should Businessmen Read Great Literature?", scholar Vigen Guroian writes, "Aristotle, Dante, Shakespeare, Dostoevsky, and Eliot teach us to imagine larger possibilities and purposes for our lives. They test our decisions with the moral wisdom of humankind. They ask us to move through the world with discernment. They show us that we possess the freedom to make of our lives what we will, and not what others choose for us, what the fates decide, or what historical forces dictate. At Wyoming Catholic College, we believe that such treasure should not remain the possession of a select few, but should be widely available, and thus our distance learning program, including these after-dinner scholar podcasts. While we're delighted to provide these broadcasts free of charge, we'd also be delighted if you, our listeners, helped us to defray the cost of production and distribution. Visit wyomingcatholic.edu/podcast to make your end-of-the-year gift today. Thank you in advance for your generosity. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.